This is the Graceful Atheist Podcast. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Graceful Atheist Podcast. My name is David, and I am trying to be the Graceful Atheist. The podcast grows by word of mouth. Tell a friend about the podcast, or consider posting on social media a favorite quote of yours from our guests, or even an audio snippet or audiogram of the podcast. That way more people will find out about the podcast. Our community manager, Arlene, continues to hold Tuesday night Facebook Rooms hangouts with the Deconversion Anonymous community. This week's guest will be there this coming Tuesday, May 3rd, at 5:30 p.m. Pacific, 8:30 p.m. Eastern. The Deconversion Anonymous group also has a number of book clubs, including one that is going over previous guest Sasha Sagan's Small Creatures Such as We, as well as a Philosophy of Science book club. Please join the community, be a part of it, bring your talents, gifts, and your interesting story to the community. That's at facebook.com/group/deconversion. Every week I say special thanks to Mike T for editing today's podcast. Today, I just want to point out what a good job Mike is doing. What you don't hear is how bad sometimes the recording can be. In this case, my guest this week, we had a lot of internet lag, and so reactions were not in the right place, and Mike has made this sound beautiful. So thank you again to Mike T. This podcast wouldn't happen without him. On to today's show. My guest today is Ursula Schneider, an artist, a leader, and a woman, all at the same time. Ursula was dedicated to the church and what she saw in other people and wanted to have what they had. She dedicated her life to teaching. She's a natural born leader, but as you might imagine, she immediately ran into the glass ceiling of the church of not being able to teach men. At one point, she was removed from leadership and shunned from the church, and this was devastating for her. Ursula is very open and honest, and she discusses suicidal ideation. So this is your content warning for suicidal thoughts. She began to go through a deconstruction process, and as she calls herself a seeker these days, she has been seeking after the truth and trying to find wholeness. She finds that in her art and in nature. You can find Ursula's art at www.ursulaschneider.art. I will have links in the show notes. If you happen to be in the Tucson, Arizona area, she is running an exhibition through May 25th at the D&R Art Gallery and Studio in Tucson, Arizona. Here is Ursula Schneider to tell her story. Ursula, welcome to the Graceful Atheist Podcast.
Hello, David. Thank you so much. Super happy to be here.
I'm so glad that you're here. Our mutual friend, Marla, got us in touch with one another, and I've really appreciated. Marla was on the podcast a month or so ago, and she's been amazing just recommending people for the show, so I appreciate it that that has happened. And Ursula, I understand that you're an artist, and so we're going to just say off the top that ursulaschneider.art is where people can find your art, and at the end, I'll give you an opportunity to tell everybody where else they can find you. But we were here to hear your story. And so let's start at the beginning. What was your faith tradition like when you were growing up?
Yeah, so it was kind of a mixed mash a little bit. My mother was Catholic, and my father, as I look back now, was whatever his woman of the moment was.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a story in itself. But so I was raised initially in the Catholic Church until I was five. And then my parents had a big conversion experience in the charismatic church. I grew up in Florida. And so in Florida, there was a real strong history of a lot of charismatic kind of awakening stuff happening back in the 70s. Maybe even earlier than I'm not sure. But so I was raised in that charismatic element for most of my youth. And went to like a Church of God, and there was one like called Word of God, and different ones, and they were all kind of people get slain in the spirit, holy rollers, you know. So there was that, and then There was a lot of dysfunction in my home life. And so my parents were divorced when I was 9, and dad left, and mom, basically she already was, but she was given over to mental illness. And so I, it was this combination of being part of this really hyper religious, family situation and not safe or mentally stable family situation. And again, lots of big stories there, but it was chaotic, I guess I would say. And so one of my experiences that was really profound as a child in church was the feeling of having been abandoned by the church, because we were so involved there constantly. And the church just kind of kept their distance because we were strange. And I think there was other things, like my sister ended up living with the pastor and his wife at the church that we were at towards the end of my parents' marriage. And so so that kind of created a weird dynamic, just in terms of, I think, the rest of the family got set aside while, you know, my sister was cared for, which was good for her, you know, and I'm glad she received that. But I remember feeling very much like, I love Jesus and I want to, you know, I want to be part of the community. And I just kind of felt like ignored and set aside. So
it's interesting. There's a couple of points of parallel here in that, although I didn't grow up very religious, my mom was an alcohol abuser. And so very chaotic, very, very chaotic. And when she had a time of sobriety and actually became a Christian, and that's why I became a Christian, very similar, where the church was so fascinated with her, like, oh, we're going to save this person, they completely ignored me for a while. So I know that feeling. That's really, you know, you think, wait a minute, aren't I important too? And especially if you were young, for in my case, I was a teenager, I was able to handle it. But like, if you're young, that's really brutal.
Yeah. And I was, and I had, you know, I had other things going against me. I had crossed eyes as a kid. And so I was kind of outcast, and just, you know, it's funny how when I'm turning 50 this year, and I look back and everything is so clear about why it went the way it went. But as a child, you don't understand, mm-hmm. you know, any of that. So, you know, I don't know if you know of the Enneagram, but I'm a lover of the Enneagram, and I'm an Enneagram 4. And some of that stuff is really classic 4 experience of feeling kind of on the outside and alone and abandoned and, you know, why doesn't anybody see me? You know, so all of that was going on.
Let me ask you this. When you were younger, you said, I love Jesus. Did you have a kind of a personal sense of your relationship with God at that time?
You know, it's funny. I have thought about this. I don't recall that idea being preached in the churches that I was a part of. So there was no discussion about personal relationship until I was an adult in the churches I attended then. So it was all about whether or not you had this experience of the Spirit falling upon you. And, you know, did you speak in tongues and all of that? And I recall, I would say I faked alongside of the people that I was attending with, because everybody would stand up and go to the front, you know, every night at revival, you know, and, so I would try to be included, you know. Yeah, I would say the personal element for me came in when I was in my adolescence, around like 11, 12, and my mother was so unwell and I was so frightened because she was so just not a safe person to be with in her paranoid schizophrenia, that I spent a lot of time praying, like, just really begging God, like, I know that my mom loves you, because she was very devout. Will you please heal her? And I can just remember like crying myself to sleep with those kinds of prayers. And then at the same time, you know, being angry at the situation that I was in and feeling unsupported in that, and thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to go to hell. My tongue's going to get cut out because, you know, Jesus is going to come back. And there was a lot of like, the idea of Jesus coming back and taking everybody to heaven. And if you didn't,
eschatology or the return,
if you hadn't, you know, been in the right place, that terrible things were going to happen to you. And the one I remember was, your tongue's going to get cut out. And so like this weird fear thing. And then on the other hand, like begging God for help and not feeling supported in that.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh man. Yeah. That's a lot to unpack. I think I want to touch just briefly on the element of, even as a child, recognizing that things were not safe and calling out to God to fix that, to make that better. And then did you then subsequently feel like God wasn't answering those prayers, or did you connect those dots?
I definitely felt that God did not answer my prayers. And so I probably about the time I turned 13, I basically just said, screw this. I'm not going to follow this God anymore. And you know, I was going to church because my mother required it of me, but, I didn't really think that God was there. And I continued in that way until, my early 20s. And there's kind of a whole story around how that happened, but I went off and did everything I could do in rebellion to what I had been taught for about 6 years.
Also not uncommon. that's pretty normal. So what changes in your 20s then? What was it that were you coming back? What changed at that point in time?
Yeah. So my husband and I met when I was 19, and we rather quickly made ourselves with child. So we got married. He was from a Christian family. And so we were married and had our baby. And, you know, we're just trying to figure out what that was going to be about and how to be parents. And, you know, we weren't prepared really at all. And so, you know, that was stressful. And we had these neighbors who were Christians, and they continually were inviting us to church and encouraging us that Jesus loved us. And, you know, and so that felt, because it was somewhat familiar, his family was also religious. It felt like, oh yeah, we should go and do that. And so I ended up going to a local church, and I just felt so connected immediately to the Spirit of God there, like not really to the people, but there was something that I saw coming from the people who were on stage leading worship that I said, that's a thing that I want. And I'm going to figure out how to get that thing. So then I'm kind of an all or nothing kind of person. And so when something captures my soul, I just kind of go crazy with it and really go after it. So I went to the woman that particularly spoke to my soul, and I asked her, like, you know, what is it that you have? And she was very humble and didn't really say, you know, anything. So then I remember some of those funny little profound things that happened. This other woman that was part of the church, who was very willing to tell me what it was that I needed to know. I went to her and I was like, what does she have? I see something that I want. And she told me, and I remember very specifically, she said, well, you need to read the Bible and remember scripture. And you need to be devoted to daily prayer and Bible time. And like just kind of this idea of giving your whole self over. And then soon after that, I went to a women's retreat who kind of said the same thing. And that really impacted me. And I came home, and my husband still remembers this. I was like, okay, I'm going to change my life. I'm going to give everything up to God. And so like, no more, you know, no more secular music and no more secular TV and no more secular really anything. And I started listening to James Dobson and Focus on the Family and, you know, reading my Bible and doing Bible studies constantly. And I just, I dove head first, like absolutely focused on, I'm going to get the light that that woman has. And I'm going to figure that out.
So at this point in time in your life, you were all in. Like there was no hesitation. You were completely committed, and it was very real to you at that point.
Absolutely. Yeah. When I look back, it's not that I had some tangible feeling at that point, but I guess what I believed is if I did enough of the things that I was being told to do, the feeling would follow. And I was myself, as I see it now, I was so vulnerable and so in need of healing from my traumatic childhood that it was really easy for me to kind of just take in whatever was being handed to me by these people who seemed so certain. You know, they knew, and like there were issues. I can remember reading certain things, and one of them was the story of Deborah, and going, hey, wait, God chose a woman and said that she could do, she could lead the people of Israel. So why do we say that women can't do things? And I went to the assistant pastor with that question, and he basically just said to me, you're misreading the scripture. That's not really what it says. Really, it was only because the men wouldn't do it, and God didn't really want a woman doing it at all, but he really didn't have an option. So no, you still can't do anything, you know?
Oh no, that's so terrible.
It is really terrible. And I'm a very strong, yeah, like confident kind of person, and I'm a natural leader. And so it was a real personal sacrifice for me to say, okay, I'm going to squash this part of myself and I'm going to be a servant, because I was constantly being told I needed to be, you know, a slave, a doulos to God. And, but I wanted to be faithful. And so, you know, I did that. And then I was trying to encourage my husband to be the leader because that's what they said was necessary. And he's not. He didn't want any part of that, really. But yeah. So now he was feeling guilt and shame because he wasn't that kind of a man. And, you know, so it was just kind of this illness, I would say, that came on us as we tried to be what we felt the church, what we felt God was telling us to be.
I think it's particularly painful when, whether personality or sexual orientation or gender or something, attitude even, that's integral to who you are as a person, but that doesn't fit the mold that you're being presented with by the church. And there's such a tendency within us to then say, well, it must be my fault. I must be doing something wrong. And the kind of anguish that a person goes through as they try to, you're basically trying to change who you are as a person, which isn't really, really possible. And that's just a really painful place to be.
Yes, absolutely. I would say my current stance is, at least in part, that is one of the biggest parts of toxicity that I see within the modern church, is squashing people, and especially women and LGBTQ people, and really anybody who's not white and male, you know, to be honest.
Yeah.
You can't be whole. You can't be fully anything. You just have to, you try to be what they are, really. You try to be a white male, which is absurd, you know?
Without getting too personal, like, how did that play out with you and your husband then? Did that cause some tension as far as you both trying to play roles that you weren't meant to play?
Yeah, you know, I would say we have been really lucky in that we're both gentle with one another. And so I wouldn't say that it created the kind of tension that I think it creates for a lot of people. But definitely there was always, for me, this sort of expectation that the Spirit of God was going to overtake him and he was suddenly going to feel empowered to do the thing that the church kept saying he was supposed to do. And the Spirit of God was going to overtake me and I was suddenly going to become a gentle, sweet spirited little lady, and so you know, I mean, I think that was hard because on the one hand, we knew one another well enough to know who each other was. And also we were actively praying that we would become something else that was being prescribed to us. So mm-hmm. I think it doesn't allow you to be your whole self within the marital relationship.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. When there's external expectations and you recognize that you're not matching up to those, that can add some tension there. Even if you have a great relationship and you're able to communicate with one another, that still is being held over your head in some way.
One thing that happened, the way it really went was I was an obvious leader. And I did take leadership in the church in the form of women's ministry and women's Bible study and worship and prayer ministries and lay inner healing ministries and like a lot of different things. So the church knew that I was gifted at that and they were very happy to take advantage of that. And I think that because I was such a natural leader, the church was pegging my husband to be a leader. So he was being pegged to be an elder. He was being pegged to lead Bible studies. He was even invited to become the worship leader of one of the churches we were at when he doesn't even sing and had zero desire to do so. But he was
okay.
Hired him for this position. And I was the one who was gifted at that.
Right.
So, you know, that created a lot of frustration because then he would try to take the wisdom that I had for, you know, leadership over the body and share it, but he didn't really know how to convey that. And he always felt like he was this kind of go-between, you know, and I wasn't like trying to tell him to do that. It just is sort of how it went.
No, I totally get it. Yeah. I think I want to backtrack just a little bit and say that we've already jumped into some of the toxic elements and I want to continue to explore that as well. But I do also want to mention the positive things that you wind up getting, and you do get some community. You do get, even in the tiny box they put you in, you did get some space to utilize your gifts, even in a contorted kind of way. And I think those are really deeply human needs to be a part of a community, to use your talents and the things that you enjoy doing. And as you mentioned, natural born leader, it's just going to come out. So in a contorted and a twisted way, it does give you the opportunity to do that to some degree or another. But now we can talk about how it continues to be toxic in the way that it tries to put you into a smaller and smaller box. And so the church simultaneously wants to use your leadership to volunteer to do work that they need done, but they also want to pigeonhole you into just the women's ministry or just children's ministry or, you know, some smaller box that you don't fit in.
Yeah. I 100% agree with you that there's a lot of things that are good that I received from church. And I even think, you know, as much as I have been hurt by the church, I'm not sure I would have been able to thrive outside of that journey. I mean, it's hard to say and predict that. But it did provide structure and a safe place to be in community where I knew, you know, kind of what the rules were. And there were people who were willing to be mentors to me and encourage me. Women who mothered me when I hadn't had mothers, women who were my sisters when I didn't have the benefit of my sister anymore. And, you know, so absolutely. And also, like, I look now, because now I'm kind of in the secular world, and I go, a lot of people don't even know just how to be nice and kind and thoughtful, yeah. You know, so some of those things I think the church does really well.
Yeah. The reason I bring that up is, and you mentioned the secular world, is I think that there are definite areas where the secular world doesn't have what the religious community has, and that we need that. Like, I'm fascinated at how we can recreate community and opportunity for people to, you know, even just something as simple as singing. Like, people love to sing, but in the secular world, there are very few opportunities to do so, and things of that nature, right? Like, how can we implement the environment where it's even possible for people to do that in a secular context?
Yeah, those are definitely questions I've been asked. I just recently, you know, Easter passed, and Easter had been obviously a very meaningful time for our family, and, you know, then COVID happened. So our whole experience of leaving the church is only just about 4 years old now. And so the first year was very just traumatic, and we can talk about that more later. But then the second year is when COVID hit. And so there was a couple of years of COVID being, you know, what we've all been dealing with. And so it didn't exactly hit me that I had no community to engage with at holiday kind of affairs until this year. And I just went, oh, wow, I need to figure out, like, what does it look like outside of church to be in a community where you gather together and you celebrate, and why do people do that? What are they even celebrating? You know, because I could see that they are, you know, my secular friends are gathering, and I'm like, yeah, why are they doing that?
Yeah, for sure. I think let's talk a bit more about community in a bit, but I do want you to tie for us from the point where you're beginning to recognize that you're being limited in the roles that you can play, where you're deciding that you're leaving the church, or, like, I don't think we've heard that part of the story yet.
Sure. So, as I think these stories often are, I look back now and I can see that was a long, drawn out process. That happened over the course of time with my own introspection. But, like, I can remember being probably in my late, maybe early 30s, studying some of Paul's letters and finding myself asking questions about why women couldn't do all the same things that men could do. And that was a real strong one for me because of those limitations that we have already talked about. And trying to look at other authors from different Christian perspectives who were saying, hey, there's maybe some different ways to read those passages, and you know, maybe women can do some of these things, and trying to bring that to my church leadership and just having them dismiss it, you know? And so then having to kind of go back to the drawing board with myself and say, okay, apparently that's not what God wants of me. So I've got to regroup, and I've got to figure out again how to kill this part of myself, because that part of myself is apparently actually demonic. I mean, that is kind of that is literally what you get told is, you know, you're listening to the doctrines of demons if you think it's okay for you as a woman to teach men.
Wow.
And so that particular theme, just that came up again and again and again. And partly because as I progressed in my ministry, so I was leading worship, I was teaching Bible study, I was leading a mixed prayer group, and then we ended up switching churches to a different church, and then I was the actual worship leader in that church, not just like kind of participating in that. And I was doing inner healing ministry. There was a ministry I did called Transformation Prayer Ministry that was really effective at helping people kind of get out of some of their unhealthy patterns. And so I was acting in capacities where there was crossover of my ministry with men mm-hmm. and women and youth. And that was kind of like going back and forth for a number of years. I mean, it was probably like 7 or 8 years where that was building. Some of it was when we did some missions work in another country, and there they didn't have as much problem with women participating more fully. So there was just kind of this constant back and forth thing happening where I was being allowed to use my gifts. They were apparently effective within the community, but then I wasn't really allowed to be fully in that, and my husband was being pegged to do it instead. And so when we left the first church that we were at and moved to another church here in town, that church, when we arrived there, we sat down with the pastor and his wife, and he said, oh, we want women to do a lot more. And I actually believe that women can preach, and I like to give training. This is the pastor speaking. I like to give training for people to be able to preach in the Sunday services. And we would love to have you participate in that. And we think that women can't be elders, but we, as men, want to always be asking our wives for their wisdom as elders, so that we can include that in kind of the way the church works. And so, you know, that felt good. And at that church, I was able to really thrive because they did promote me in some of the areas of ministry that I was really good at. And then at some point they asked my husband if he would be an elder, and he came home and he said, well, you know, they're asking me to be an elder. And so we talked about whether or not he should do that. And as we discussed it, we said, well, we should probably really ask for clarification on what they think in terms of women's roles, because on the one hand, the pastor has said women can preach. On the other hand, he's given the preaching class like 3 times since we've been here, and each time there's a convenient reason why I haven't been invited. So what's that about? So he went and he asked, and they said, oh, well, you know, maybe we should, as an elder board, we'll do a study on women's roles together. And then once we kind of have some conclusions, then we can address that. And so what they did was they said, go home to all the men, go home and do some study and see what you come back with. And we'll bring all this together, you know, when we meet. So Jeremy came home, my husband, and he said, this is what they said to do. Would you like to help? And I'm like, damn straight, you know, absolutely, I would like to help. And so I just started digging in, and we together found so much teaching from the more progressive side of Christianity that said no, women could, you know, be pastors and elders and, you know, all of the things. And so he went back and he presented some of that information, and the pastor just kind of lost his mind about that.
Okay.
And was like, if you think that women can be elders, then we're going to have to be done.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that night his wife contacted me and just like totally trashed me and said I was a terrible person and that I was trying to destroy the church, and I was trying to steal the church, and I was trying to become the pastor, and all of this stuff. And mind you, like, my whole goal in wanting to be able to preach was that thing, that ministry I did, the transformation prayer ministry. I saw so much good come out of it. I said, I just want to share that with the church, because right now it's really only going to be the women, and I'd like to see the men be set free as well. And so that's what I wanted to do. Like, I just wanted to share that one thing.
Yeah.
And anyway, as you can imagine, it de-escalated pretty hardcore from there. I was seen as, I think, just, I mean, what happened was they believed that I really was trying to steal the church. And we had meeting after meeting privately, in which nobody heard anybody else. And ultimately, we were asked to leave of our own free will. But really, we were told that we couldn't stay. So,
yeah.
So we got pushed out of the church. It was devastating because we loved that church, and that was our family. You know, our kids by that time had grown up, and it was just my husband and I at home. And that really was our entire community. It was our entire life. I mean, literally all of my energy went to work for the church that was unpaid.
Unpaid. Right, that's that.
So then after that, you know, there was some sort of idea that we were going to repair the relationship with the pastor and his wife, who had been close friends of ours. And bottom line, what happened was I tried to talk with them about how I had felt we had arrived at the place that we were now. And the pastor took it as a terrible affront on him personally, and said, I don't ever want you to contact me again. I don't ever want to hear from you again. And I don't ever want to hear from Jeremy again. And
man,
the two of you need to never be a part of my life again. And he blocked me on Facebook, and, you know, just like, and all of his family did as well. And the other elders in the church. And so there was basically a shunning that happened. So we lost our whole community literally in like the span of, 2 months. It just, everything gone instantly.
That is devastating. And I don't think that many pastors really understand that the devastation that they level on people when they do something like that, right? Like, we all can tell horror stories, right? But like, I just think in particular that scenario where a pastor uses their power to push you out of the church is just, it's so inhumane, right? It's so cruel. I don't think they grasp what it is in fact that they are doing. And maybe I'm giving them too much credit.
I had to go back and forth between those thoughts of like, how can he not know, how can he not know the devastation? And then going to, but I think he is a decent human being until he felt threatened, you know? So, you know, I would like to believe that he really doesn't understand what he did. And it was his own inner work that needed to be done that hasn't been done, that was coming out, and he felt threatened, and, you know, hurt people. I hope that's true.
Without going into lots of details, I did have a similar-ish experience where, you know, there's just a trail of broken hearts, you know, people who were pushed out of a church by a particular pastor from a few decades ago. And I had to come to grips to, you know, just, I pity him, right? He was so focused on his sense of rightness that he lost his humanity. And, you know, I was a little bit hurt in that process, but like, I had a little perspective, and I pity him now. Like, I think he's a shell of a human being. And so anyway, not to get too far into that, but I feel for you how devastating that must be, the loss of community, the loss of the people who you loved, the people who ostensibly loved you.
Yeah. And I, I don't know how whether where you wanted to go next, but I will say about that and I think this is true for a lot of people that I've come across. I feel pretty fortunate that I'm still alive, because I was certainly suicidal during that season, and I'm not somebody who has walked that road really before. I've struggled with depression, but I haven't told you our whole story, but like just our whole life story. But I've been through, most people, when I tell them my story, they're like, how are you alive at all? And yet that experience was the most devastating experience I have had from all kinds of other hellish things. And that's like when you say, you know, that these pastors don't understand the devastation. I just don't think they don't grasp it at all. And what I hear people doing, you know, like in the media and stuff, are pastors saying, well, those people never believed. And, you know, I mean, like the people who know me even still, and the people who knew me then, would have said about me, Ursula is the strongest Christian I know.
Right, right.
And it would have been true. Like, I loved God with every part of my being, every part of my being. I mean, I dedicated every day. So like that whole thing is just, it's bizarre to me that you can say that you walk in, you know, the love of God and do that to people is just, I don't understand.
It is not terribly Jesus-like.
No.
So it sounds like that was beyond devastating if we get into the realm of suicidal thoughts. How did you come out of that? How did you recover from that?
So, you know, it's been a process. One thing I will say about myself that I know now is that I'm pretty damn strong. And I had been through enough hard things prior to that I had collected some tools along the way for dealing with deep, dark depression. And, you know, initially I didn't lose my faith right away. I continued to cry out to God for help during that time. And, I did a lot of just sitting with where I was and writing out my feelings, and just trying to, I did a lot of self-examination because one of the things, that is difficult is there's somebody in my life who's very close to me who is inclined with the best of intentions always to make the assumption that it must be something in myself that caused that problem. So this person saw me as needing to self-examine to determine how I had caused it, more or less. And so I, you know, I did do a lot of that. And in the end, I concluded that I did not do anything wrong. Like I was as open and honest as I could be. I was not the one who went to the board, you know, that was my husband. And I had a genuine, you know, realistic question given the things that had been told to me, about what my role was within that community. So I think being able to see myself accurately in that regard is part of what ultimately saved me. I got into therapy. I'm like a big proponent of therapy.
Okay. Yeah.
Everybody needs a therapist.
Yeah. We at the podcast are very pro therapy.
Yeah. And then the other thing I would say, and definitely I think therapy helped me with this was, although, you know, I might have started this even before, I really started digging into my art.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Finding the thing that was in my soul. I spent a lot of time in nature, just out exploring and noticing the beauty that surrounded me. And, you know, it began to feel like that was church. I'm very in tune, I guess I would say, spiritually. And I would talk to the trees, and I live in the desert. So I would talk to the cactus, and I would talk to, you know, the lizards and whatever, and just kind of pour out what was the pain that was there. And I felt, and I don't want to, like, I'm not going to make some claim about literalist experience, but I felt as though nature embraced me. I felt welcomed there and accepted there. And I felt like I was part of a community there, which sounds, I think, a little strange if you haven't had that experience. But I think in a very real sense, nature saved me. Just being able to be in a place where there wasn't criticism, you know?
Yeah, without making any metaphysical claims, I think awe is a human experience, and nature is one of the best places to experience awe. It's something about literally being next to something greater, larger, bigger than yourself, and recognizing the interconnectedness of it all. And again, without making any metaphysical claims there at all, there's something really important about that at a deep human level.
Yes, absolutely.
So you say that you still had some sense of faith. Take us the rest of the story from there. What helped that along, or what started to break that apart further?
Yeah. So, you know, I guess I should probably preface it by saying I'm in very much a place of not knowing at present. I would definitely not call myself an atheist. I've definitely entertained that possibility. But I find I can't quite go there. But what happens when you start to question some of these closely held doctrines, which, you know, for us, it started with the women's position in the church, is things do start to unravel. And I remember having a friend, one of my friends who disowned me, said to me that, you know, you're on the slippery slope, which we've all heard.
Yes.
And I was like, no, I'm not. No, I don't think so. I'm still totally a woman of faith. And she turned out to be 100% right about that. And I think it's just one of those things where you start to unravel that thing. And then you have to ask, well, do I think that this book, the Bible that everything is taken from, is really true and inerrant, which was the position from my church background? You know, do I really think that it was inspired of God? And so then I begin to research how the Bible came to be the Bible. And I go, oh, it was a bunch of old men who were arguing over it, and they, you know, killed off the ones they didn't agree with. That's probably not, you know, really highly credible then in terms of how the Bible can be trusted, because now I understand that it was done with political agendas and power agendas. And then you start to ask questions about, you know, should I really be thinking that LGBTQ people are wrong? And you read alternative opinions about that. You go, oh, well, I don't think I agree with that anymore. And it's just one thing after another, the whole race issue in the last few years, and coming to understand more and more how the white supremacist power structure has been very much engaged with the church, and, you know, has taken just oppression as part of its mandate, really, I think. And, you know, and I'm not an authority on those things. I just know that I've read a lot of opinions that have kind of just made me go, huh, I think we have some real stuff to unravel in the way that we approach people. And I, at this point, I've looked into a lot of things. I've looked into native religion, and I've looked into Buddhism, and I've looked into Hindu and tarot and Wicca and like all of that stuff. And none of it did I did I come away going, yeah, that's for me. But all of it had pieces of wisdom that I appreciated. And so, you know, ultimately kind of where I've landed for now is I know that I can't allow myself to be under the, you know, authority of some teacher or guru. So that's a definite for me.
That's a no-no.
That's a no-no. And I know that I don't want to be part of an organized system of religion, because I think those organized structures just breed power struggles and that kind of thing. And I just don't want to be boxed into any particular belief set, because I've concluded that as I go through life and I try on new ideas, each of them has something to offer me that's valuable. And I also know that next year I'm probably going to find something else that resonates that is opposite, you know, not even to mention like science and psychology. And I'm very interested in psychology and all the advancements in, you know, neurological stuff about like how our brains work and community and all of these things. So did I answer your question?
Yeah. No, definitely. I don't know how much you know about the podcast. I'll just give you the 30-second, you know, version of that, is that we're trying to talk about embracing our humanity and embracing the humanity of others. So again, not really making a metaphysical claim of just like, how do we care for each other? How do we care for ourselves? How can we develop community in a secular fashion, in a pluralistic fashion, that kind of thing. But also recognizing a pretty wide spectrum of where people land, right? People deconstruct to various levels, and some are agnostics, some are hardcore atheists, and pretty wide open to wherever people are at, as long as they're willing to talk about it, talk it out, that kind of thing. So you're in good company is what I'm saying, as far as the listenership. So Ursula, wherever you're at now, but outside of the church context, how do you personally find community? What are the sources of connection with other people that you try to have in your life now?
Yeah, David, that's such a great question, because it's been a huge challenge to find community. You get so accustomed to your community being built in, and you don't even get to think about like who you're going to hang out with. And so as I, one of the things that I realized while I was deconstructing was that I didn't know how to make friends with people that I actually valued and who valued me reciprocally. Mm. Because I think in the church, there's not a opportunity to even make those decisions for yourself. You're not empowered to decide, oh, I want to be in relationship with this person, and I'd prefer not to be in relationship with that person. It's more like you will be in relationship with them because they're in the pew next to you, you know? So I just want to kind of set it up, my comments up in contrast to that, because it's been a real kind of push-pull experience for me in how to do that. So I would say the first thing that was necessary for me to develop community was just to get to know myself and who I am and what I like and don't like, and to be able to feel empowered to make choices based on that. So that was just like a foundation. And a lot of guilt was associated with that, because, you know, it felt like it was selfish to have boundaries or to say, you know, what I needed. And I wanted to love people, and I wanted them to feel loved. And so what has happened is I've worked on that. I'm still working on that. I kind of feel like I'm going to work on that for a long time. And I began getting involved in various art groups in my community. So I started out just taking classes at, we have a place called the Arizona Sonoran Desert Museum and there's an art institute there. So I began by taking classes there. I'm actually an instructor there now, which is super exciting for me. And just getting to know people in that community. And then there's also a few local groups where people go out and plein air paint, which is just painting outside. So I've met some really nice people in that community. I've met people through our local gardening community. So it's been really a very deliberate choice to go and find people that share interests with me. So it's been that deliberate choice to meet people. And then I've also been able to connect with some people that I did used to attend church with, but who have also been going through their own deconstruction journeys of a sort.
Yeah.
And so that's been really nice, because one thing I have found is if you're just in the deconstruction community and you move into the secular community, most of the people there are super well-meaning and want to be supportive, but they don't understand the life that you lived.
Right.
And it's hard to discuss those, just the little daily mundane things that kind of come up that are issues, you know, as you're healing from that. So it's, I guess it's been a bit of a mix mash.
Well, first of all, I love all of those answers. I think it's important for people to do exactly what you did. What do I want? What do I want to do? What do I care about? Who are the kinds of people I want to be around? And then deliberately, intentionally, consciously go out and do those things. I think that's awesome. And then secondly, the whole reason for this podcast was the recognition that the secular community is missing what it is like to have been a person of faith, and then to deconstruct that to whichever degree you do. And so hopefully we're continuing that kind of community as well. So, and would be interested to have you be a part of that as well, to ongoing process. So. Ursula, I want to give you some time to talk about your art. First of all, what medium is it? And then what are the things that inspire you?
Yeah. So, I would say nature is my biggest inspiration at this point, but I also have used for a long time words in my art. I also am a writer, and so I like to incorporate story, and at the same time, I spend a lot of time talking with the people that I know and love about how we develop as human beings and what it means to live and walk in our own power. That's, I think, especially important to me as a woman, having felt disempowered within the church setting. Mm-hmm. So I have this kind of strange combination, I think, of using my creative voice to write about what it means to be fully human, actually, which is kind of what you just said. And when I create something visually, I'm trying to point out the beauty and joy and delight that I see around me, which, you know, a lot of art gets really like, oh, we want to make some sort of statement and we're going to be, you know, super deep about it. And I don't know that my visual art comes across that way. So I'm still working on how to combine the things that I love. So I use the medium of photography, and I use the medium of written word, prose and poetry. And I also use the medium of soft pastel. That's probably my primary visual medium. And then I do a lot of mixed media as well, with like watercolor and ink, and then pastel over the top of that. So there's this big kind of conglomeration. In my perfect world, I'm eventually going to write a book that incorporates all of those mediums somehow. I'm a big picture person. And so what I want to kind of create is this understanding for the individual viewing that you are valuable in this world. You are empowered. You have something that you're supposed to be bringing into being, and being inspired by what is around you, no matter how ordinary that is part of what is going to move you to that place.
Mm-hmm.
So still kind of figuring that out, but that's kind of the work that I'm dreaming into being.
Okay. And then how can people find you and your artwork?
Yeah, so I have a website, which is www.ursulaschneider.art. They can also find me most easily, honestly, on my regular personal Facebook page. That's where you'll see everything that I post, because I post, as I said, a lot of written work as well. So that's just Ursula Schneider on Facebook. And I don't know if you post pictures with yours, but you know, they'll see my picture. But I also have a business page on Facebook, which is Ursula Schneider Art.
Excellent. Excellent.
Oh, and Instagram. I should mention Instagram. It's Ursula Schneider Art also.
Excellent. And we'll have links in the show notes for that. So Ursula, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a joy.
Final thoughts on the episode. As I said in the episode, it breaks my heart for people who, for whatever reason, did not fit the mold of the evangelical culture. For many of my guests, that is the case, whether it's sexual orientation or the color of their skin, or in Ursula's case, being a leader, being a big personality, being someone who others want to follow, and having to be stuffed into the box of the role of women that's acceptable within the church. This is a common theme. Next week's guest has a similar story to tell. But I think this is just one more area where the culture of evangelicalism, and in my mind, Christianity in general, limits people, removes their humanity, and makes them feel like there's something wrong with them. When Ursula talked about being rejected by the church leadership and the pastor basically kicking her out and shunning her, causing depression and some suicidal ideation, that power that Christian leadership wields is often devastating. It's wielded in the name of righteousness, in the name of removing sin from the camp in some cases, but it is almost always destructive and hurtful to the human beings involved. Ursula ultimately calls herself a seeker, and you could hear near the end there that she's tried out a few other faiths. She's just trying to figure out what she believes and why. But I want to read you a quote. This is the quote that former guest Marla sent me to encourage me to interview Ursula. This is Ursula. "My story is, I suppose, the story of a sincere seeker who, it turns out, is actually a huge threat to the organization of the church structure. Silly me, I thought the church was the place to be a seeker. But it turns out that they don't want seekers, they want adherents. I was never a very good adherent in hindsight, but I gave my whole life to the church because I misunderstood that reality, and in return, the church did its level best to silence me completely." I think that captures Ursula's story in a nutshell there. I'm very glad to hear that art and nature are the things that are giving Ursula meaning and purpose and a voice and a place to exercise her big personality. If you want to find Ursula's art, you can find that at www.ursulaschneider.art. And if you happen to be in the Tucson, Arizona area, she has an exhibition at the DNR Art Gallery Studio until May 25th. Go check that out. I want to thank Ursula for being on the podcast, for being so vulnerable and honest, talking about the hurt, the devastation, and the mental health that resulted from that. And also the joy of freedom on the other side, of expressing oneself in art, of connecting with nature, and being the big personality, the leader, and the artist that she is. Thank you so much, Ursula, for being on the podcast. The Secular Grace Thought of the Week is inspired by Ursula, but not necessarily about Ursula. This idea of being a seeker is really, really significant. And I love the way that she wanted to be a seeker. And she insightfully points out that the church wants adherents, not seekers. It is human nature to be curious, to try things, to make mistakes, to be unique and not conform to a particular standard. We have cataloged pretty thoroughly the destructive nature of complementarianism and anti-LGBTQ and racism within the church, but just what it is ostensibly supposed to be about is finding truth, as Ursula points out. And I want to bring this around to deconstruction in general. So many hot takes from Christian media, Christian leadership these days about deconstruction and how far off the mark they are of what it is about. Someone like Ursula, who tried over and over and over again to use the talents and gifts that she had to lead and teach and to seek after truth, and yet they needed Ursula to be inside a box where she could be contained and controlled. Where Christian leadership is really missing the point entirely is about doubt. Similar to the role of women, doubt has a specific box that it is allowed to be in. You're allowed to have trivial doubt. You are allowed to ask questions as long as you don't find answers outside of the bubble, outside of the prescribed answers. If you don't happen to find the apologetic arguments as convincing, that's not okay. That's outside the box. And as I've quoted a number of times, Jennifer Michael Hecht points out that doubt is a feature of Christianity. The minute you make a religion about belief, doubt is the other side of the coin. The church has never dealt with doubt properly. This is the atheist's advice to pastors. You have doubters in your church right now, whether they use the term deconstruction or not. And instead of trying to correct them or keep them in the box, try listening. Really listening. Someone who is truly pastoral will listen and love someone in their doubt rather than trying to correct them or to push them out, or in the worst case scenario, like Ursula experienced, shun them and remove them from the church entirely. That is not what Jesus would do. Next week, we have community member Anne. Anne has a very similar story in that she's a big personality, a natural born leader, and she has a wild story of multiple denominations, multiple faith traditions, and not being accepted or allowed to lead in any of them. That is coming up next week, and we've got lots of other interviews in the pipeline. Until then, my name is David, and I am trying to be the graceful atheist. Join me and be graceful human beings. Time for the footnotes. The beat is called Waves from Makai Beats. Links will be in the show notes. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can promote it on your social media. You can subscribe to it in your favorite podcast application, and you can rate and review it on podchaser.com. You can also support the podcast by clicking on the affiliate links for books on gracefulatheist.com. If you have podcast production experience and you would like to participate with the podcast, please get in touch with me. Have you gone through a faith transition and do you need to tell your story? Reach out. If you are a creator or work in the deconstruction, deconversion, or secular humanism spaces and would like to be on the podcast, just ask. If you'd like to financially support the podcast, there's links in the show notes. To find me, you can Google Graceful Atheist, you can Google Deconversion, you can Google Secular Grace, you can send me an email, gracefulatheist@gmail.com, or you can check out the website, gracefulatheist.com. My name is David, and I am trying to be the graceful atheist. Join me and be graceful human beings. Thank you. This has been the Graceful Atheist Podcast.